That's amazing. Well, it's true. Bruce and I go back a long way. I was probably one of the only MBAs that walked into his office back in 1991 and said, what is this thing of design about? I haven't just graduated from business school. I spent about a year working on Wall Street and said, you know, that's not for me. I really love this other stuff. And I started meeting people. And Bruce was one of the first people that I met. So we became fast friends. In fact, we lived on the same street in New York City there for a while I lived here. And have been on this journey together for many years. So it's very interesting that we find each other at this place in time where design is so incredibly important. And I must acknowledge him for making me a guru this summer, which was shocking to me, of course. But he was very interested in the work that we were doing at my startup company, Peer Insight, because we decided to follow the path of the economy, which is that now 80% of the GDP is made up of services. Yet the whole innovation conversation is about products. And so what's going on there? Now, luckily, when I was at IDEO, I've been gone there 4 years, I worked on some very interesting service innovation strategy projects, including with our friend Adrian Corey here, the Amtrak Acela program, which is one of the first places that I learned a tremendous amount in about service innovation. So we've been studying service innovation. We have a consortium-based model where we have our client companies pay a fee to belong to a membership where we study how they do in service innovation, compare them to others, et cetera. But one of the principles that we've been fortunate to uncover was that, you know, in order to be a great service innovator, you have to have great customer experience design capabilities. And so we've been working down that path. And as we're trying to build out what it really means, we think about it in a very holistic way, in that it really needs to be something that is part and parcel of everything you do in your company. So I'm going to sort of approach this conversation from that standpoint. So I just want to start with some inspiration from Keats. Nothing is real until it's experienced. And I was just sitting here realizing that this is the great slide when I start talking to service companies who are completely absent on the notion of prototyping, that this is, you know, this is the slide to show them that, you know, nothing is real until it's experienced. And if you can't experience what you're conceptualizing, then it's not real yet, right? So you can't really understand it. Okay, so I want to start with a pop quiz here. One of the companies we admire most is Progressive Insurance. Okay, so in Progressive Insurance, you can do a lot online, and they will actually show you how your profile shows up, or you can do pricing with other companies, right? So what does this tell you about their customer experience? You're applying for insurance for Progressive. It's telling you what your Progressive insurance is going to cost. It's going to tell you what it's going to cost from other companies as well. What does it tell you? Anybody? Anybody? Peter? What? You can trust them because they know what's going on. Okay? Anything else? They want low-risk customers. Very good. Open source, where they just want to be transparent about the operation, right? Well, it's very interesting. Progressive, we watch them very carefully. They actually have a vice president of customer experience design that has a broad range of responsibilities in that company. One reason they do this is to tell customers to go away from them, right? So they want you to see if somebody's going to charge you less money, go to them. We don't want you, in other words. Their underwriting margin is 7.5%, where in their industry it's about -2%. Okay, so they make a lot of money on knowing exactly who their right customer is and telling other customers that apply, you know, we'd rather not have you here. But, of course, it does solve these other issues, too, of being transparent, showing you that they know how to deal with data, et cetera, and give you a more modern experience than many insurance companies do. Okay, so that's just one example of customer experience design. Now, we've decided to give this a little definition in our firm, so just to put some definition around it. So we say customer experiences are ongoing relationships. So it's not a discrete event that you have. You're expecting to have an ongoing relationship with the provider, defined by multiple touch points. Of course, this speaks very well to the service environment, where there are many more than touch points than discrete products. Engage senses, evolve over time. Include both functional and emotional signals, which is something that service providers and basically anybody that's in this business needs to get. Functional is a baseline now. You know, when you want to get into real customer experience design, you want to get into the emotional state, right? That's one of the great things that design can help you do. But it's amazing how absent many service companies we found are on this particular front, and how difficult it is for them to get there because of the current methods that they use, like, you know, standard marketing, survey-based marketing research, no ethnography, things like that, can never get into a place where you can actually be very very robust around the emotional elements. Okay, so there's a little bit of a definition for us all. And I want to talk about a few principles that we've uncovered in our research. So we've done a tremendous amount of research. We've probably studied 30 to 40 customer experience design organizations, and so I'm going to communicate here some patterns that we're seeing, but I want to communicate them within the metaphor of a car engine, because it's a great metaphor, really. And you can say, well, you know, are we a Ferrari or are we a 1967 Beetle, you know, and what's the difference in the engines that you might see? So what's the inputs, you know, what kind of fuel do you put in it, what's the quality of the materials that you're using, et cetera, how do all the pieces integrate with each other, that sort of thing. Because in the end, what we understand is that great customer experience companies think about this in a very holistic, very integrated way. It has to do with all the functions in the organization are optimized around customer experience design. So let's talk about the first one. Great customer experience companies identify and win the moments of truth. Now, let's just get on the same page about a moment of truth, and I'll show you this through the eyes of Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble has, of course, they're a product company, not a service company, but they have a vocabulary that they use in that company that is shorthand. They have the F-mot and the S-mot, okay? First moment of truth and the second moment of, and the second moment of truth. First moment of truth is when you walk up to that store shelf, CPG company, walk up the store shelf, and you're going to choose among competing alternatives for the product that you're going to have. So they work really hard on making sure that they stand out at the shelf and that their bottles and everything else are communicating to you at that first moment of truth, because they realize that they'll never get to the second moment of truth unless they win you at the first moment of truth. Okay, so the second moment of truth in P&G language is the use scenario, right? So you're using the bottle, doing whatever it is that you do with a P&G product. What goes on there? Okay, so this is the way they think about it. In customer experience design organizations, there's a lot of moments of truth that go along a continuum, typically, use scenario, typically. And I'll show you a good example here. Starwood's Hotels is in our consortium, and we admire them greatly for the things that they do. They certainly think about customer experience design in a very holistic way. And they were one of the first companies to sort of study the business traveler and understand what it was like for people to walk into hotel rooms and what various things in the hotel room meant to them and so on and so forth. But they identified this exhale moment where you would close the door and sort of exhale. You finally put your bags down, and you're on your own. You're finally alone. You're out of the fray, and so on and so forth. And they focused on the bed as a place to be able to delight you, to be able to invite you, to give you a different kind of experience. One thing they realized that people didn't like, they thought, you know, bedspreads and so forth were dirty and, you know, they're just not the greatest things in the world. But that was something, a signature piece that they were known for over a period of time. They had 5 or 6 year lead on this, and now you see every single company that, you know, you go and it's a white bed and so on and so forth. In fact, Marriott just did this great big splashy thing. You've probably seen their ads around and so forth. And come to, you know, find out they're going to have a white bed, okay? So it's very interesting. They reported in the Washington Post what the white bed was going to cost, okay? The white bed across their system, putting the white bed in, costs $800 million, okay? It's a very expensive moment of truth, but nevertheless, they thought it would be very important. So we call this phenomena choosing empathy over optimization, where providers can actually be more empathetic with their customers, not optimizing their system, but in the end, they get the margin back that they end up paying, the $800 million, ought to come back with them and increase loyalty margin, et cetera, et cetera. Let's talk about another one. Many of you are probably work in the brand domain. We talked about brand a little bit already this morning, but when we work with companies that are interested in customer experience design, the first question I ask them is, what's going on with your brand? How, you know, are you feeling good about your brand? Is your brand perceived well? So on and so forth. So great customer experience design companies use their brand values as a North Star for designing experiences. Now, You see this in spades brand work going on in B2C companies all the time. They spend a lot of money knowing what their, where their brand is, how they're perceived, et cetera, et cetera. It's an ongoing dynamic thing. What you don't see is in B2B companies. The brand often is like a logo, right? Or some, or you have these situations like in GE or Citibank or whatever. So the brand is really held at the corporate level, and people down in the divisions don't get much access to brand work, if you will. And so it makes it very difficult for people in divisions to design great experiences, because the brand values give the constraints to design teams and creative teams to be able to know what to do. You know, so a couple weeks ago, I was just up at Whirlpool, and I was talking to the head of design there, Chuck Jones, who's been written about extensively, and he talked tremendously about what the brand architecture that he's got with KitchenAid and Whirlpool and so forth, what it gives them in terms of a signpost, North Star, in terms of how they interpret these brands. It makes it much more easy for designers to actually show you something that's consistent with the brand values if it's well articulated. On the other hand, if it's not well articulated, what happens? Okay, you get very muddled communication. It's difficult for the teams to communicate. Nobody knows what to do. Okay, so for those of you, you know, design, we know this, right? We people in the design community know about brand. They know the connection between design and brand. What you need to understand is that business people don't really understand this. And so if you ever have the opportunity to, you know, if you're ever trying to convince a business person, you know, what this means, you just should take them to Whole Foods, right? This is a great example of how every place you look, every place you go in that store, you are looking at great execution of the brand. In fact, you probably run into this sign, say, what are the brand values? What's this all about here? But every single place that you go and try to get a person, maybe in a, you know, a bank, insurance company, you know, rail car agency, airline, whatever, to understand that, you know, every place you go, the brand needs to show up, and the brand needs to show up in the way you want it to show up. And it makes the work of design and creativity so much easier if that is the case. Another pattern that we are seeing in customer experience design organizations is a lot of focus on information technology systems. Now, we've got great representation here about what's going on in the technology world. We all know we've got more technology at our fingertips than ever before in the history of mankind. And one of the parallels I made early on, because, you know, I made my first, you know, my first 10, 12 years was spent in product development, and I just made the shift to service development not that long ago. But one of the tenets of product development, if you go to I teach my product development class, I tell my students, you know, burnish this into your head, platforms. Platforms are the basis for how you start designing things. It drives your derivative strategy. It drives your strategy on what the next platforms are going to be, et cetera, et cetera. Well, information technology platforms are just the same, are the analog in the service world. And smart companies recognize this. And oftentimes they can manipulate their technology to drive incredible business results. And I'll tell you a little story here. It's a very well-documented story. It's been written actually by the CEO, Gary Loveman Harris. So Loveman is an HBS professor who understands operations management and information technology and so on and so forth. He's a consultant working for Harris, and Harris, like, muddled, and they're in an environment where all the other big casino companies are starting to put in, like, big, you know, shows and spas and spending huge amounts of money. And they're wondering, you know, is this the right strategy for us? Okay, so at that point, a lot of these companies had what amounted to maybe frequent flyer level CRM systems that, you know, would tell them, you know, basically be able to do rewards and stuff like that. Basically, you know, top level, off the shelf kind of software. But Loveman said, no, we're not doing that. We're going to hire our own people. We're going to crunch this data, and we're going to figure out what's going on here. And so what he did was, first of all, he figured out what people were doing in the casinos, and so he could understand what the patterns of behavior were. Secondly, he figured out what the most profitable customers are. Okay, so this is a pattern. We've seen this before in the Progressive Insurance thing. So he optimizes his whole system around serving the most profitable customers, and everybody else can go to MGM Grand. He doesn't, you know, they don't care, because that's where they're making their money. They become the most profitable of all the casino companies. So it's very interesting, the use and the linking of these two things. Now, they were not always so operationally focused on what the people were doing. So again, this comes back to the business systems. The last, I think in 2004, they gave away $20 million in bonuses to frontline employees. Now, these are people that, you know, open the door and serve you your meals and, you know, carry your bags and everything else. That's a lot of money for frontline employees to be in the system. But they really took a holistic view of customer experience and rolled it out across, you know, everything that they do. Again, another example of this. Here's a really good example also. Entrust your customers to be co-creators of their own experience. We're so used to technology now, and we're so used to what it can do for you. And fundamentally, people want, they want convenience, they want freedom, they want flexibility. These are things that are resonant in almost everything that we look at these days in society. Everybody wants these things. Why? Because we're all so busy and we're all, you know, running around and so on and so forth. Well, there's a lot of technologies out there that allow you to let your customers co-create their own experience. So you think about manufacturing, right? There's mass customization. You can make your own. You can go on the Nike website and make your own tennis shoe. You can go on the Land's End site and make your own pair of pants if you want to, right? We have technologies like collaborative filtering where Amazon will help you shop by showing you other what other people have bought. Tebow, the same sort of thing. And on and on. And the list goes on. We have loyalty programs, et cetera, et cetera. But I think Netflix is a great example of this, where they've used a combination of technologies, a lot of this is sort of collaborative filtering technologies, to take that very stagnant and really awful experience of going to the video store and turn it into something that's really, you know, pretty exciting, where people can co-create their own experience. And to a certain extent, Netflix was invented by a frustrated person who just said, you know, this is crazy. We can do so much more than this in terms of this experience, and by his own sort of taking himself on a customer journey, recognized that there were technologies that it could exist that would help you, that would mirror the way you think about going to a film, right? Or to help serve you up. Well, I'm thinking about the kind of film I want to watch, or the director I want to see, or, you know, something like that, which database technologies will let you do now. Take away this whole notion of having to go to a store, a physical place. And then one of the big bugaboos in this whole customer experience system from a conventional video store standpoint was this notion of late fees. So they took away the late fees. So all of a sudden, the customer experience is so much better for people that you know, are annoyed by those kind of things. Now, you know, I'm actually not a Netflix subscriber, but I really do hate going to the video store because I have little kids and it's always a nightmare. So I just don't have that much time to watch videos these days, I guess. So anyway, and an idea here. And then here's a really good one too. Use an ecosystem approach to orchestrate numerous business models that drive value, okay? So if you're a CEO, you've got a big company, your strategy departments probably have all these consultants walking in, and they're talking about adjacencies, right? They're saying, you know, look at the adjacencies, what's next to you? You know, what's next to you in the ecosystem? Let's think about this as an ecosystem approach. And so, you know, you see companies like GM getting into financial services because, of course, you're going to put a piece of financing on your car. Or you see Dell get into things like Network Service Administration because that's an adjacency in their business. So it's sort of a natural thing, but it's not a natural act. And I think one of the great stories here in the ecosystem, and there are many, and I think there are many that I haven't even actually been mastered yet, but one of the things that we love about the iPod story is that this is an ecosystem that existed that actually nobody was doing anything about. And so they come along and, you know, MP3 players were just not very accessible and not very exciting, you know, as a piece of consumer electronics until these other pieces and parts were added, right? So they added services. So Apple had to invent a service model for themselves, which I'm sure was not easy. And that, you know, that's part of the ecosystem, software, hardware, whole experience, this iconic thing. And so, you know, it's been a runaway success. I think I saw the numbers, somebody showed me numbers, 220% up iPod sales, 40% up Mac sales, big halo effect going on here because people are finally discovering the magic of Apple. But when I work with companies that are in ecosystem environments and I think about what Apple has done, It makes me think even more that the notion of a holistic approach to customer experience is where it's at. Because many companies can make acquisitions and, you know, try to play in the ecosystem, but to make a magical experience happen is not what you see a lot of times. So when I think about what's going on at Apple, I see an incredible culture. I see all kinds of design-led processes in place. I see a heck of a lot of discipline in place there, which you know, discipline and innovation, that's a whole other conversation, which I tend to talk about the discipline part more than the creativity part and so forth. So, but this is not easy, and it's not a natural act for companies to have different business models operating in the same place. You know, a lot of organizations that have ecosystem opportunities are in these kind of siloed P&L situations, and they can't, you know, everything is set up for them to operate in the siloed P&L situation, and to try to get them to all, you know, play in the same thing is just really difficult when you have managers that have incentives and the whole thing is structured in a certain way to do business in a certain way. It's a huge shift. And so when I talk about customer experience being a seismic thing in our economy, I think about these things because so much about business process has to change in order for this to be done really well. And one of the telling things is that newer companies who have all this consciousness and who have all this technology are doing it better than old companies. You take a Progressive Insurance who came into being, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, at a time when we had a plethora of technology, people knew what to do with it, there were opportunities in the insurance business, and they, you know, made a whole new set of business models, and the old insurance companies are just kind of sitting there stagnant, saying, wondering what happened to themselves. So that's my conversation about that. But listen, let's see how it bears out in terms of numbers. So many of the designers here might be bowled over by this set of numbers, but just take a look at how this bears out, okay? Now, we didn't put companies like Google in here because they're sort of off the charts, but these kind of mainstream companies that are operating in mainstream industries. And the point here is that these companies have the same pressures and have the same cost structures as their competitors do. They just do things differently. They do things more intuitively. They research differently. They apply their knowledge about customer experience in a different kind of way. And the results show. It's 2x revenue growth and 4x profit growth over the last 5 years, if you look at their revenue and their net income. These are the companies that we admire. There's other ones. You can ask us, you know, there's some weird things in here like why is Apple at negative 14%? Well, listen, that's a 5-year number. They're just coming up from behind with these new numbers. Okay, so in another 5 years, they'll look really different. Now let's look at how they performed next to the S&P index. 5-year S&P index, the same thing. $1,000 investment on January 1st, 2000 would have returned, okay? S&P companies, $889, okay? You'd be losing money. Customer experience portfolio, what is it, 18.4%. So it does bear out. And of course, there's a huge investment in making your company want to go this way, but you know, the evidence is there that the margins do end up paying for itself. And once you get the engine built, you can keep moving on and on and on. You get to be a Toyota, and then you get to be a BMW, and then you get to be a Ferrari, and pretty soon, zoom, nobody's going to catch up with you. So that's my point of view about customer experiences.